Dragon, Reel 4.
In the last engagement, they suffered pretty heavy casualties. Later, I witnessed the historic last parade of the brigade in Barcelona, with Passionaria's emotional and inspiring speech of thanks and the love and gratitude shown by the vast crowds of Spanish people. After this, the British battalion was sent to Ripoll, near the French frontier, to await repatriation through France, which took place in December 1938. Many stories can be told about the activities of the lads while they were staying in Ripoll, and also of their conduct when they were met at the frontier by both the French representatives and representatives from Britain. On leaving Spain, and when they arrived in Britain, the brigadiers made a pledge. It was to continue undeviatingly the fight for Spain until Spain was free, naturally to do it by other means than they had been during the war. Between their return and the outbreak of World War II, considerable sums of money were raised by the newly formed International Brigade Association and Friends of Republican Spain. That was the title that they adopted. And they, as a matter of fact, there were various officers in the brigade from time to time. Death took away, say, secretaries like Jack Brent and Bill Rowe. And the present officers are Sam Wild, who is the president, Bill Alexander, who chairs the executive committee meetings, and an executive committee of which of which Bill Alexander and Bob Doyle, who are present here, are members. I don't give the names of other members who are not present. I haven't got on the list by me. When the war broke out, the Second World War, numbers of brigaders like Bill Alexander, Bob Cooney, Clive Branson, etc., joined our army, and many tales could be told of the obstacles that they had to overcome in this process. After the war, the brigade stepped up its activity. The monthly paper, Volunteer for Liberty, which ran for some years, was dedicated to this objective. It exposed the terrible repression and mass executions, with scores of thousands in prison. Conferences of the movement were held to secure support for the struggles of the Spanish people. We, like many others, had felt at the end of the war that it was certain that the Franco government would be overthrown by the situation existing in Spain, and also by the action of the powers, the victorious Allied powers, especially after Franco had sent his Blue Division against the Russians and had provided bases for the German submarines. We have raised money to send observers to trials that took place in Spain. This work has also had the support of MPs and trade union leading figures. A number of trade unions, like the miners, nationally and on a district basis, the Transport and General Workers Union, etc., have given money and support to the Spanish people's struggle. As recently as this year, Bill Painter, former Commissar in the International Brigade and also former General Secretary of the National Union of Mine Workers, has acted as secretary of a sponsoring committee, which included trade union leaders like Jack Jones of the TNGWU, Hugh Scanlon AUEW, Joe Gormley Miners, Clive Jenkins ASTMS, George Basnett, Municipal and General Workers, Jeffrey Drain Nalgo, Tom Jackson, Postal Workers, Ken Gill, ASTAS, Alan Sapper of the Cine Technicians, to convene a very successful conference in Spain. And both Sam Russell and myself gave him every possible help. That conference was held in the Friends Meeting House, London, in February. At it, Marcelina Camacho of the Workers' Committee, Commissions, members of the Spanish Socialist Party, of the UGT, and the Communist Party, spoke unitedly, demanding amnesty for all political prisoners, free trade unions, and the legalizing of all political parties, as well as democratic elections for the Spanish Cortes. Our IB members had a place of honor at this conference. And following this conference, similar actions have taken place in Scotland, Wales, and Lancashire, to mention only a few.
The contacts with Spanish trade unions, there are close contacts with the Spanish trade unionists still.
What?
There are close contacts.
Yes.
The meeting you mentioned, February, that's February of 1976.
Yes.
I see. Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, that's interesting.
Right, I thought I would give a little about, a lot more could be said about the follow-up thing. By the way, there's one additional point that ought to be made. I think that this seminar itself is a logical follow-up to the activities that the brigade has been carrying through, because it's intended, I assume, to put on record from a rather fast-diminishing band of people,
exactly.
Stuff. Food position was very, very bad at that time.
What about Barcelona?
Well, in the summer of 1938 and the autumn, we stayed in a hotel, and one of the principal dishes that you could get was bacalao. You know what bacalao is?
It's
dried salted fish, cod, usually. Unfortunately, a lot of it came from Scotland, unfortunately. And that was really one of the main dishes, done in various ways. Maybe some soup and bread. Of course, there were still hotels where a number of the correspondents, like Sefton Delmar of the Express, where there were meals that were quite substantial meals with wine, etc. Incidentally, it's maybe worth mentioning that I came across two correspondents for whom I developed quite a high regard. One was it William Forrest of the Chronicle, the News Chronicle, who was a consistently favourable reporter on the Republican side, when quite a lot of distortion was taking place in respect to the events in Spain. The other, from my point of view, strangely enough, was a Buckley of the Telegraph. And if you are able to get a hold of and look at the issues of the Telegraph during the Spanish Civil War, I think you will be surprised in many cases at the objectivity of them, with a, if anything, emphasis on the Republican side.
He did impress you that way.
Yes, Buckley married a Spanish girl, and he spoke Spanish, and he did a very, very good job as a reporter, getting news and putting it forward objectively, I would say, which was very important at that time. Incidentally, I understand that after the war, he stayed on and settled in Spain to live. I think he carried on for a period as a correspondent for the Telegraph. Of course, he'll be an old man if he's alive now. I don't know anything more about him. But I know that Forrest was alive 2 years ago, because there was a BBC television broadcast in which Bill Alexander and I participated from the point of view of Brigade. This chap Kemp, who I think has been on recently again, who was a fascist supporter, went there as a fascist. Tom Dreiberg, I think, was another participant in the broadcast, and Forrest was there, and he contributed also, and was quite a pro-Republican, and he supported the struggle that had been put up in Spain.
How important were the journalists for you as commissar?
Well, I would say we didn't have, while in the early stages, when I was a commissar, we had practically no journalists near us at that time from the press. Most journalists were either in Madrid at the time, some were in Barcelona and Valencia making visits up to the front, but we never came across them. Of course, this was in the very early days, you see, and they didn't get up anyway to any of these battle fronts like Jarama, not to my knowledge. They may have been able to cover some from a distance, some of the events that were taking place, like the Guadalajara actions, which the Italians were involved in, where they got this very heavy defeat. But frankly, in the Ebro offensive, there were no doubt about it that the journalists were able to get up. Not like us right at the beginning, but for instance, when I was coming back from my first visit up there, I met Sefton Delmer crossing the Ebro and going up to the front.
Mm. Yeah. How important were the writers, the various famous people who were there? I mean, people like Auden, Hemingway, Spender.
I would say they had considerable importance, because a lot depended, of course, on the reaction, but in general, I think, if my memory serves me right, most of the people like Hemingway and others were favorably disposed to the Republican cause. We had a journalist that was over there, Claude Coburn, Frank Pitcairn of the Daily Worker, and he was an experienced journalist. There were other journalists, of course, as well, and as I've already mentioned, Foster and Buckley, etc. You see, when I was there the second time, it was just before the country was cut in two. The fascist offensive was driving to the sea, and it was cutting off the southern bit from
Catalonia.
That's why the Ebro offensive was down almost at the point of the cut, you know, because the Ebro flowed into the sea, and the intention was to get across and get a big chunk out and drive further back in order to try and force the a retreat. Yes. But of course, the force, we hadn't enough forces and a heavy enough weight of artillery and tanks to really successfully carry it through. We just missed getting Gondessa by a hairbreadth. Mm. I forget how many kilometres that was from the Ebro, about 30 or 40.
Yes. Coming back to this point of journalists, writers, the Spanish documents of the time give a considerable amount of importance to propaganda. How important was that from your point of view?
I would say it was quite important. It was quite important from the point of view of two things. First of all, to get the case of the Republican government presented to the world. Remember, there was non-intervention. That the press in general was hostile. There were exceptions, of course, like the Chronicle of the, I'm talking about the bourgeois press. But in the Western world, my recollection is that the press was quite hostile, and of course we had a government that was favourable to Franco, the Tory government. The press was important also from the point of view of the morale in Spain. Of course, the Republicans had not too bad a machine for disseminating information and a press. Remember, of course, there was a tremendous amount of illiteracy that was being tackled even at that time by the Republican government. Haldane wrote about that afterwards as one of the biggest achievements of the government. And in the army, there was large-scale educational work carried on to teach reading and writing, for instance, for a start, to many of the soldiers. These are all points which had a bearing on the overall situation as far as propaganda was concerned. And from my point of view, it was a very important from the point of view of the morale of the soldiers. Now, remember, I was primarily concerned when I was a commissar with British soldiers. That's to say, Britishers, or, if you like, Englishmen, Irishmen, Scotsmen, and Americans. Although at the latter stages, the American thing was out of touch to a considerable extent with the Americans, because they built up their own machine very rapidly.
I see. From this point of view of the sort of propaganda in the image of the regime, how did you report, or how was the fall of Caballero and the installation of Negrín? That was May 1937.
Wasn't I wasn't there.
You weren't there at the time. No. How was that reported in England?
Well, I've not got a very vivid recollection of the thing. What was reported was the trouble with the Pum rising.
How was that?
And I would say that on the whole it was reported in a hostile way. That is to say, hostile to the Republican government and the actions in Catalonia. Of course, there was a considerable amount of a fog of obscuring of what was happening. For instance, there was this front in Catalonia which for long periods saw no action at all, and where at one stage, it's quite clear now, and it was clear at that time to the Republicans, if they could have launched an offensive at that time, there was every possibility of driving through the fascist lines and reaching the Basque country, and it would have made a terrific difference in connection with the attacks that took place in the fall of Guernica and the Basque towns. Because that was a possibility, because at that stage the fascists had been advanced their main forces down to the north of Madrid. They were held back there. There was the drive to try and cut the Madrid-Valencia road. There was the advance from the south, from Malaga, by the fascists. And their main military forces were there against the Republic. And of course, unfortunately, here was the most industrialized part of Spain at that time, in Catalonia. Barcelona, the principal industrial center. And yet, because of the political situation, it was not possible to really effectively organize the front and organize the troops for the offensive.
From your impression, how accurate is Orwell's description of that front?
Well, I can't just remember all the points that he made about the thing, but there is no doubt about it that at that front there was a whole lot of anarchist influence, which meant that the troops really didn't obey any centralized direction. It was on the basis of what they decided, or what particular groups of anarchists decided that the troops acted.
How did you react to the arrest and murder of Nin, Andres Nin?
Well, at that time I didn't know about it.
What's your subsequent impression of it?
Well, the impression I can't really, because I'm not sure of the facts of the thing, and I wouldn't like to pass a judgment on the thing.
We talked a bit yesterday about the attitude and the policy of the Soviet Union towards politics in Western Europe. There was a move, you mentioned, to the notion of popular front in, I think you said 1935, was that right? Around that time, the notion of that. Presumably in the earlier years, in the late 20s, there was still this notion of dictatorship of the proletariat and so on. How did that square with the Republic? By which I mean to say, when the Republic came along, the Communist Party, to many people, seemed to be the least revolutionary party. It was going for popular democracy, collaboration with the bourgeoisie in a popular front government, and so on and so forth. How did you react to that? Didn't it seem to you a sort of shift in policy? Or did it seem a logical thing at the time?
Well, remember, first, that I had come... Now I'm giving you my personal reactions. Well, first of all, you've got to remember, I come through a period when, after the betrayal of the general strike, in which I was an activist and the chairman of a big central strike committee in Glasgow, and therefore felt terrifically strongly about the betrayal. After that betrayal, our reaction was that the men that did it were traitors to the working class movement. I'm talking about the General Council of the TUC. When they capitulated, we might say also some of them were cowards. And very bitter about the left, because the Purcells, Swales, and others like that, I can't remember all the names on the General Council at the time, had been very active in connection with the Anglo-Soviet Trade Union Committee that had been set up in Britain, following the report of the delegation that went to the Soviet Union, and also they had supported the ban on the movement of coal in 1925, which brought about Red Friday. And although we had warned, and talked now about the communists, Although we had warned that the government was buying time and that we, the working class, should prepare, there was no real preparation made by the General's Council. They were hoping to get a compromise and negotiate that as far as the miners were concerned. That was the position then. After the strike, our reaction was very bitter and hostile. And there was an influence from the Soviet Union also, because the slogan, so to speak, or the description used of the left labour leaders as being social fascists really emanated from the Comintern. At least it was given every support from the Comintern and pushed, put it that way. And that meant that there was this period right up until about 31 or so when this was the line, and when, as a result, there was isolation to a considerable extent in the trade union movement of the communists and the left that were supporting the communists, like the minority movement, which had been built up prior to the general strike.
What were your political aims and objectives then during that period?
Well, our political aims and objectives were to get action by the masses against the government's policy, which was cutting social services. Remember, there was mass unemployment, 2 million, 2.5 million, it got up to about 3 million over that period. Even when the war broke out, I think there was still over 1 million unemployed. But our job was affected, our objective of getting this united action below, that was the below, and the job. That was affected by the fact that we were also getting isolated because of the kind of political line we were taking towards the trade union leaders, and even getting down to lower ranks of the trade unions. And it was only when, from about 31, 32 onwards, we began to, from experiences in life itself, realise that this was getting nowhere, and a change began to take place. And as far as the British Party was concerned, the principal protagonist of that change was Pollitt, who in 1930 had been made a secretary of the party.
Yeah. And his political philosophy at that time was what?
It was to build up bridges with the trade union movement, to establish a mass rank and file movement, but to get it embracing the widest possible numbers of trade unionists, and on a limited program. That's to say, a limited program of objectives as far as economic objectives were concerned, yeah. Social objectives. Yeah. That was how it was developing in Britain. Then it was also obviously changing in other countries, and I think that France was probably the most important immediate example of that, because round about, I think it was 34, 35, the French party started to develop this unity in practice with the socialists.
And this was the Popular Front policy.
Yes. And as a matter of fact, that policy had already achieved a considerable number of things when the World Congress of the CI took place in June 1935. And at that Congress, of course, they changed the General Secretary and made Dimitrov, who was already experienced because he had worked in what was called the Western European Bureau, and he'd worked in Germany, etc. And you know, he had been arrested and there was the trial and all that sort of thing, and the mass movement to freedom, in which, by the way, Isabel played quite a part in Britain. That was the actual atmosphere in which we met. And that was only a year before the outbreak of the war in Spain, the civil war in Spain. Therefore, there was already in the Spanish party the influence of what had happened in France, and the party had also been represented at the Communist International. José Díaz was the secretary, and they therefore were coming into this struggle in a situation where they already accepted the concept of a mass movement to defeat fascism, a united movement in which we were bound to associate ourselves with bourgeois elements and elements that normally, or rather over the past period, we had been at arm's length from there. And all these were factors. And as I don't know whether I mentioned this, but we had a position in Britain where we had still got the remnants of the split in the trade unions. We had the United Mine Workers of Scotland. We had this clothing worker, United Clothing Workers, which was a much smaller sort of breakaway organization, much more artificial, because the United Mine Workers had a mass basis in Scotland. That was reflected in the votes that had taken place. But remember, in Scotland there were about six or seven district unions in existence at that time.
Yeah.